Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Friends of the Libraries at Boston University and the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Speaking will be Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. Professor Basevich will discuss the upcoming presidential election, the war in Iraq, and his new book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Introducing Professor Basevich is Dr. John LaRosa, President of the Friends of the Libraries at Boston University.
We are very pleased to have with us tonight the distinguished BU University professor and award-winning author, Dr. Andrew Basevich. Dr. Basevich is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and he served in the United States Army in Vietnam from the summer of 1970 until the summer of 1971. His military career continued into the early 1990s, and he retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel. He holds a PhD in American diplomatic history from Princeton University, and before joining the faculty of Boston University in 1998, he taught both at West Point and at Johns Hopkins University. He is the author of several books, and his writings have appeared in many national publications, such as Foreign Affairs, The Nation, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Professor Basevich's work has been praised both by the conservative and the liberal population in this country. We are very, very happy to have him here tonight. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I would ask you to please greet, and I am honored to introduce Professor Andrew Basevich.
Well, thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to speak to you. This actually is the first time I've ever been described as a beloved professor. These are precarious, even frightening times. To a greater extent than I can remember, perhaps in ways not seen since the traumatic events of 1968 in our country, the United States really does seem to be teetering on the brink of an abyss. And worse, our political system seems ill-prepared and desperately ill-equipped to respond effectively. Now, it seems to me that the urgent imperative of the moment is really twofold. And the first is to see the world as it is, and the second, perhaps more difficult, is to see ourselves as we are, which implies viewing the past without illusions. This implies abandoning the mythic narrative of America's relationship with the world beyond our borders. Now, the mythic narrative goes like this: a nation providentially set apart in the new world and wanting nothing more than to tend to its own affairs, grudgingly responded to calls that it assumed the mantle of global leadership in order to preserve the possibility of human freedom. This mythic narrative is wildly misleading. Worse, it obstructs efforts today to gauge accurately the predicament in which we find ourselves. A truer and also more useful narrative would allow that the United States became a great power because it sought power and succeeded spectacularly in acquiring it. Now, among the factors contributing to that spectacular success, two stand out. First, the folly of our 20th century competitors, chiefly Japan and Germany, then the Soviet Union, but also including from an earlier period Great Britain and France. The second factor contributing to our success is the skill, savvy, and ruthlessness of American statesmen. The central theme of the policies devised by those statesmen over the past two centuries is not one of isolationism reluctantly abandoned somewhere between September 1939 and December 1941. Rather, the central theme of U.S. foreign policy is expansionism, beginning in the wake of the American Revolution and continuing down to the present day. What did this expansionist project aim to achieve? Well, in the 19th century, the emphasis was on the acquisition of territory so that this republic could extend from sea to shining sea, and also on the opening of markets. For a brief moment in 1898, the focus shifted to acquiring colonies, an unhappy experiment with formal empire that was soon abandoned. Then in the 20th century, the focus shifted again, and the priorities became political stability, economic and military access, adherence to American norms, and in strategically critical regions that became more numerous and more expansive as time came along, outright hegemony. To sum it up in a single phrase, an expansionist foreign policy in the 20th century sought the creation of an informal empire. What means did the United States employ to achieve these aims? Well, put simply, whatever was necessary and whatever worked. At various times, U.S. policy emphasized diplomacy, dissembling, threats and coercion, invasion and conquest, infiltration and filibustering, acquisitions paid for with cold, hard cash, and population removal, or what we would today describe as ethnic cleansing. With what results? Well, apart from a few missteps along the way, and in that category I might include the annexation of the Philippines, the mishandling of Cuba, and the Vietnam War, the strategy of expansionism proved immensely successful. Now, this was not a morally uplifting enterprise. Statecraft is seldom, if ever, a morally uplifting enterprise. It was, however, a remarkably effective enterprise. As a result, by the midpoint of the 20th century, right around the time that I was born, the United States had become the most powerful, the richest, and in the eyes of the white majority at least, the freest nation on the face of the earth. Now let me emphasize in particular that last point. A foreign policy of expansion enhanced American power. Power brought with it material abundance. And incrementally over time, abundance made freedom accessible to an ever-growing percentage of the American people. To put it another way, abundance, the anticipation and the reality of an ever larger economic pie, endowed our political system with an elasticity that enabled and encouraged political leaders to deal with social problems through the distribution of largesse, cutting into the American dream those who had been excluded or marginalized without requiring the privileged to make any significant sacrifices. Politically, there was no need to rob Peter to pay Paul. There was enough to go around to satisfy the demands and the expectations of both. Granted, none of this happened quickly. None of this happened without struggle by the deprived and the oppressed. Indeed, it was not until the United States reached the acme of its economic dominance in the 1950s and 1960s that the circle of freedom finally widened enough to admit blacks, women, Latinos, gays, and the disabled. But here's the problem. Right then, in the 1960s, more or less coinciding with the Vietnam War, the positive correlation between expansion, power, abundance, and freedom began to become undone. With few people taking proper notice, from that time forward, further efforts at expansionism have led to the squandering of American power. Expansionist policies have undercut American prosperity. And to the extent that the central government, and especially the executive branch, began to acquire excessive authority, the emphasis on expansionism abroad also began to compromise American freedom at home. The end of the Cold War helped obscure this ominous development. History had ended, it was said, and we declared ourselves the winner. During the 1990s, in describing the position of the United States in the new post-Cold War order, it became fashionable to employ terms like indispensable nation, sole superpower, to refer to a unipolar global order. But this was all hogwash. The numbers told a different story. Numbers related to trade imbalances, persistent federal deficits and mushrooming entitlement programs, plummeting savings rates, and energy dependence. To balance the books, increasingly we began to resort to borrowing. Now, borrowing from foreign governments. Counting on others to underwrite an American way of life, increasingly based on the prospect of unfettered consumption. The actual theme of the post-Cold War era, basically the decade of the 1990s, the actual theme of the post-Cold War era was this. Americans were refusing to live within their means, and they expected someone else to foot the bill. The United States was increasingly becoming a debtor nation. When it came to energy and credit, it was becoming increasingly dependent on others. Yet to forestall the day of reckoning, when it came to foreign policy, post-Cold War administrations hewed to the expansionist tradition of American statecraft. Expansionist efforts now increasingly focused on imposing our will on the vast and troubled region of the world today commonly referred to as the Greater Middle East. We need to understand that the misnamed Global War on Terror, initiated by George W. Bush, ought to be seen as an expression of this urge to expand. Now, of course, the immediate rationale for that war is to prevent the recurrence of another 9/11. But the chosen means to that end is to assert American power throughout the greater Middle East. The true object of the exercise is to transform this region, to employ American power, both hard and soft, to impose order while ensuring stability, order, access, both economic and military, and to ensure adherence to American norms. In essence, to establish an ambiguous U.S. hegemony so that the Islamic world will no longer serve as a breeding ground for terrorists who wish to kill us. The idea is to accomplish in the Middle East what the United States, albeit in radically different circumstances and with considerable help, accomplished in Germany and Japan 60 years ago. Don't take my word for it. Here is Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking at a Pentagon press conference on September 18, 2001, 1 week after the 9/11 attacks. Quote, "We have a choice. Either to change the way we live, which is unacceptable, or to change the way that they live, and we chose the latter." Now, I don't want to make too much of a verb tense, but I do believe that the verb tense actually, in this case, is rather revealing. We chose the latter. That is to say, within a week of the 9/11 attacks, the basic decision had already been made at the highest levels of the United States government. The Bush administration was committed to changing the way they live. And there's no need here, I think, to explain in any great detail who we mean by they. They really encompasses the population, roughly, 1.4 billion people who live in the Islamic world. Well, changing the way they live meant that the United States was going to have to bring about a fundamental political and cultural transformation of the Islamic world. Here is Rumsfeld in a memo to President Bush. This would be a classified communication. Here is Rumsfeld in a memo to President Bush on September 30th, 2001, so almost 3 weeks after 9/11. Quote, "If the war..." And here we're not referring to the Iraq War. The Iraq War hasn't happened yet. We're talking about the larger enterprise, the global war. "If the war does not significantly change the world's political map, the United States will not achieve its aim." End of quote. Along similar lines, here's Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith. Feith was the chief strategist in the Pentagon in the first Bush administration. Feith, in a memo written to Rumsfeld in May 2004, "America's purpose," wrote Feith, "was," quote, "to transform the Middle East and the broader world of Islam generally," end of quote. Now, oddly, or perhaps not so oddly, given the cultural revolution that we have experienced in our country over the past 40 years or so, the administration laid out this very bold agenda without making any effort to mobilize the country in support. In every war in American history, going back to the War of 1812, up to this war, in every war in American history, when the United States has entered into a conflict, the first thing that the federal government does is to expand the size of the army, to raise up the wherewithal in order to achieve our purpose. Not this time. The Bush administration embarked upon a global war intended to change the way they live without bothering to expand the size of the United States military. The president apparently assumed that the military assets in existence in September 2001 would suffice for all the tasks that lay ahead. The Bush administration after 9/11 did not ask the American people to make any sacrifices. Indeed, within about a week of the 9/11 attacks, President Bush explicitly urged the American people to carry on as if there were no war. And I have to say, we did as instructed. Now, the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003 was supposed to jumpstart this strategy of transformation. Iraq was really intended to be a demonstration project. Success there, which was anticipated to be achieved quickly and economically, success there would set the stage for success elsewhere in the region. in Iran, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. I don't mean that there was a specific blueprint. Phase one is Iraq. Phase two is Syria. I also don't mean that they intended to in a sequence, invade and occupy one country after another. What I do mean is that they expected that this emphatic demonstration of our capacity and our will to employ power, that through that demonstration, we would fundamentally transform power relationships throughout the region so that others would, in essence, get in line, toe the line. Here's Condoleezza Rice, quoted in Bob Woodward's recently released bestseller. Quote, "I have believed from day one that Iraq was going to change the face of the Middle East. I have never stopped believing that." End of quote. Well, the invasion of Iraq has not changed the face of the Middle East, at least not in the way that Rice and others predicted. The invasion of Iraq has not brought stability to the region. If anything, the reverse is true. The invasion of Iraq has not enhanced our influence and standing in the Islamic world. It has not caused others to fall in line or to toe the line. It has, in fact, fostered intense anti-Americanism. Now, by the time the next president takes office in January, the sixth anniversary of the Iraq War will be approaching. At that point, the United States will have expended probably, I don't think anybody is doing a very careful job of keeping the books, but probably somewhere in the vicinity of $1 trillion. While sacrificing the lives of over 4,000 soldiers, and yet when the new president takes office, there will still be 150 or so thousand American troops in Iraq, along, let us not forget, with another 30,000 in Afghanistan. In other words, if you're keeping score, during his two terms as president, President Bush will have begun two wars, and he will leave office without bringing either of those to a conclusion. The question demands our attention. Can anyone possibly think at this stage that a strategy of changing the way they live is plausible or affordable? Now, if we are willing to see the world as it is and to see ourselves as we really are, what exactly might we learn? Well, I think one thing that we might learn is that despite our remarkable efforts over the past 7 years, we might learn that the Islamic world is not nearly as malleable as we imagined back in 2001. We might also learn that U.S. power, and especially the military power that we were once certain was our strong suit, that U.S. power is not nearly as great as we once imagined. The fact is that transforming the greater Middle East lies beyond our capacity. The effort that President Bush inaugurated after 9/11 is not enhancing American power. It is not enhancing American prosperity. It is not enhancing American freedom. Just the reverse is true. And therefore, to persist on the course that we are following will lead only to ever greater debt and ever greater dependence. The point, therefore, is not simply that the Bush administration's post-9/11 strategy is failing, but that the foreign policy of expansionism to which we have adhered for so long has now run its course. That tradition no longer serves our purposes. to husband our power, which we really need to do, to ensure that future generations will share in the American dream, and above all, preserve our freedom, requires that we abandon that foreign policy tradition of expansionism and devise an entirely new approach to dealing with the world. This is the task that we must confront. Contra Rumsfeld. That task requires that we give up the effort to change the way they live and begin paying more attention to changing the way we live so that we can preserve that which we claim to value most, namely our freedom. Now, this brings me to my concluding point, which relates to the ongoing presidential campaign. Given the events of the past several years, punctuated by the developments of the past several weeks, a debate about the fundamentals of U.S. foreign policy ought to be at the very center of the presidential contest. The election ought to, in a sense, function as a referendum on U.S. foreign policy, and more specifically, a referendum on the global war on terror. The key questions, in my judgment, are these. Does open-ended global war, that's what the global war on terror is, does open-ended global war make sense as a way for framing U.S. policy? Or is the concept of open-ended global war flawed and self-defeating? I believe it is. And should that be the case, what might a sensible, affordable, realistic, and sustainable strategic alternative look like? But these questions are not part of the debate between Senator McCain and Senator Obama. Their differences, increasingly as they articulate them, relate not to differences in fundamental strategy, but to differences in operational priorities. Senator McCain says, elect me and I'll achieve victory in Iraq, which he says is the central front in the global war on terror. No, says Senator Obama, elect me and I'll send more U.S. troops to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is the true central front in the global war on terror. Now, there are differences here, and the differences are not inconsequential. But both of the candidates implicitly, at least, endorse the notion of an open-ended global war on terror as providing the essential core of U.S. foreign policy. And it's for this reason that when it comes to foreign policy, at least, and I'm not referring here to other issues, when it comes to foreign policy, at least, this election is likely to yield more continuity than the much-touted change. And we will continue to avert our eyes from the very issues that urgently demand our attention. I thank you very much, and I look forward to your comments and to your questions. Thank you.
Okay, so, I see that you kind of disagree with both presidential candidates, so do you question their motives or judgments? And if it's their judgments, what is it that you know that they don't know?
So, I think they share the same motive, and the motive is that each one is determined to be elected president of the United States, and that tends, in the context of a campaign, to take priority over all other considerations.
Okay.
I don't question their judgment in the sense that I don't claim to know that much about how do you get elected. They are responding to the advice of people who are political professionals, and the political professionals at this stage of the campaign especially, I think, on matters that relate to national security, are not urging them to emphasize sharp differences, but are actually urging them to strike positions that move toward the center, right? So their motives are understandable. Probably their behavior is understandable given those motives. But I'm not running for national office and could care less about those considerations. And it seems to me that from the point of view of serving the national interest, that we would be best served if we had an election in which we could discern two sharply distinct alternatives, not on operational priorities, not on the question of whether Iraq is more important than Afghanistan or whether Afghanistan is more important than Iraq, but on the larger strategic question, which has to do with things like, does open-ended global war really provide the best way for us to defend ourselves against the threat posed by violent Islamic radicalism? Now, that's a real threat. But of course, once you admit the possibility that global war might not be the proper response to violent Islamic radicalism, I think that almost necessarily you find yourselves addressing this first order question. How grave is that threat? After 9/11, the Bush administration portrayed the threat as akin to the threat posed by Nazi Germany. I think they overstated the threat. And to see the threat more realistically, again, I'm not dismissing the threat. It's real, it's dangerous, but it's not existential. To see the threat as it really is, I think, begins to open up the possibility of devising alternatives to open-ended global war. Now, why don't, apart from the fact that they're both eagerly trying to run for the presidency, are they unable to see that because they have defective judgment? No. They can't see that or won't see that, in large part because they draw their national security advisors from basically a common pool of talent, and everybody within that pool basically shares similar assumptions. If they had different advisors who didn't represent the kind of the national security tradition that we have evolved over the past 50 years, and if they weren't assigning first priority to getting elected, then one of the two, most likely Senator Obama, might actually have something fresh and distinctive to offer.
You mentioned that we should, instead of trying to change the way they live, change the way we live. And I'm wondering what you think are some of the key areas that we should try to address in changing the way that we live here at home.
We need to live within our means. I mean, we need to live within our means. We need to live within our means as individuals in our households. We need to live within our means in terms of the services provided for by government at various levels. I'm no economist, but I do believe there is no free lunch. All right? Everything has to be paid for. And we have been living, the current financial crisis is emblematic of this inclination. We have assumed that there's no need to live within our means, that there are ways to extend that line of credit. There are ways of manipulating paper that the bills won't come due. I think that's simply an utterly defective way to approach government and an utterly defective way to approach life. Now, to say that implies, I think, a substantial reordering or reevaluation of our culture. Because the culture, this is where I sound like a real old fuddy-duddy, the culture really has come to be one that places such emphasis on consumption, endless consumption. I think the light began to go on for me when, this must have been 4 or 5 years ago, when I began to realize that the new biggest day on the American calendar was Black Friday. And I said, what's Black Friday? Well, Black Friday is the day after Thanksgiving. Black Friday is the day in which the holiday season for shopping begins, and the willingness of the American consumer to spend on Black Friday has been widely seen as indicative of the economic health of the nation. It's pretty significant, I think, when how much we're willing to spend as opposed to how much we're willing to produce or how much we're saving becomes a primary indicator of economic health. So there's a cultural change that would be required. I see no evidence of any kind of cultural change happening, hence my pessimism. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. My question is kind of a follow-up, actually, to hers. If Americans were to change their lifestyles, do you think that our reputations have been so permanently damaged in the Middle East that we cannot even repair them?
Well, no. I mean, no, so long as the purposes that we pursue are wise ones. I mean, we're not going to sort of refurbish our reputation by behaving over a couple of years and then sort of immediately launch back in this project of trying to change the way they live. It is true that we changed the way the Germans live, changed the way their behavior has permanently been modified. One could make a similar argument, I think, with regard to Japan. But we have to understand the circumstances that existed in order that facilitated the transformation of post-war Germany and Japan. One of the circumstances was that was waging total war. And devastating, flattening both of those countries so that they had nothing. The second circumstance, probably equally important, was that as soon as World War II ended, the Cold War began. And both the Germans and the Japanese faced a pivotal choice. The West Germans and the Japanese faced a pivotal choice. And that is, whose camp do you wish to be in? And they wisely chose to be in the Western camp, but part of the price to be in the Western camp is they needed to play by Western rules. Now, I go through all that to simply say that it's not as if it is impossible to bring about transformation. It is. But you have to have very special circumstances. And those circumstances do not exist today with regard to the greater Middle East. We do not wish to. It would be wrong to visit the kind of devastation on countries in that part of the world that we visited on Germany and Japan. Moreover, politically, we no longer, in comparison to the immediate post-World War II era, we don't have the levers that we can use to encourage them to change their ways. So we can refurbish our standing in the eyes of others, and we very much need to do so. And frankly, regardless of who wins this election, that's going to happen. I don't think that either of these guys is going to repeat the worst sort of errors of the Bush administration. It just doesn't follow that once we get our reputation restored, that we can once again commit ourselves to this idea of changing the way they live. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Celia. I'm a junior in comm, and my question has to do with the imperialistic presidency, and I think that you started to talk about it at the beginning of your presentation, and it definitely has to do with what you're talking about, but my question is, how can we, in this next administration, reduce the role of the president, bring it back down to size, bring back checks and balances, and make the executive branch pull their power down to the point where we might be able to have more of a say of what's going on in foreign nations.
Well, I think that you used the correct verb there. How can we make them? And the point is, the people who want to be president, and the people who surround the people who want to be president, you know, who yearn to be the next national security advisor or yearn to be the next secretary, they are not running this campaign so that they can take over the big offices in Washington, D.C., and then shed prerogatives, right? The people who are running for the presidency and the people who surround those people want to own the imperial presidency. They want to exercise the powers of the imperial presidency. So to get them to surrender those powers or to reduce those powers, they're going to have to be made to change. And I think you know the answer to the question. It's not anything you and I can particularly do. We've got a constitution, and the constitution is written in a way to try to ensure that there are checks and balances, and those checks and balances in large part have been compromised, forfeited by a feckless Congress. I mean, the imperial presidency came into existence, and this is a story that probably takes 3, 4, 5 decades from World War II going forward. The imperial presidency comes into existence not entirely because presidents are seizing power, but because the Congress is thrusting power onto the president, especially in anything that touches on national security. So what we need is, and I mean, this is really idealistic, what we need is a Congress that fulfills its responsibilities, that behaves in ways that are consistent with some sort of definition of the common good, that, here's a radical thought, places the interests of the country above the interests of their party. If the Congress would do what it's supposed to do, in many respects, the problem would solve itself. Again, I cannot tell you that I'm particularly optimistic that that's going to happen, but I do believe that's where the solution lies. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, to the extent that you believe that the United States was a moral leader in the world, what do you think the United States can do in its foreign and domestic policy to regain this role, perhaps maybe with the use of soft power?
Well, I think it's easy to overstate the extent to which the United States has been the moral leader. On the other hand, I'm certainly not going to dismiss out of hand both the value of being perceived to be a moral leader, nor am I going to dismiss out of hand simply the importance of having certain values be supported and prevailed in our human existence while other values should be discarded and disappear. In my book, I try to use Reinhold Niebuhr as a touchstone of the argument that I make at various times. Many of you know who Reinhold Niebuhr was, a Protestant theologian, tremendously influential public intellectual in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and even in the 1960s. And Niebuhr defined himself, as I define myself, as a realist when it comes to international politics, meaning at the end of the day, nations behave in certain ways, not because they think it's right, but because they perceive their interest to be served by that behavior. And all nations conform to that view. Niebuhr said, the essence of statecraft is to identify what he called points of concurrence between your own needs, your own interests, and the needs and interests of other nations. To pursue an agenda where you'll accomplish something that serves you while it serves them, and by God, that's where opportunities for collaboration exist. And so we should ask ourselves, I think, I am going to answer your question, are there any points of concurrence between our interests and the interests of other nations and indeed interests of the rest of the world. And I think it's self-evident that there are points of concurrence. It's not difficult to think of them. One example would be the threat posed by climate change. What would be the impact on our moral standing if the United States were perceived to be a leader on this issue? I think potentially it would be profound, although I'm not advocating that we tend to that problem so we could enhance our moral standing. I'm advocating that we attend to that problem because it really matters to the well-being of the next generation and the generation beyond that. So that's the way I would approach the problem. Yes, sir.
I remember it being a big problem for George Bush never coming up with an exit strategy, or not soon enough anyway. It was sort of the same thing as not clearly defining victory, but I understand that both Barack and McCain want to stay in Afghanistan or increase troop levels. Do you see any indication that either have a clear definition of victory, an exit strategy, an intention to leave, any of this?
Well, two things. One is this concept of this phrase, exit strategy, not useful, okay, in the sense that it seems to imply that war is an instrument over which I can exert rather precise control. The historical experience of war says that it's at a minimum very difficult to control and may well be impossible to control. So the notion that I'm going to go in and I'm going to go this far and I'm going to achieve just these things and then say, okay, got all the items checked off my list and now I'm going to leave, is not a useful way to think about war. Now, with regard specifically to Afghanistan, there are members of the faculty of our university who I hope are not here because they will know infinitely more about the history of Afghanistan than I do. The little I know persuades me that this is a place that, that has never been effectively governed from Kabul. That is to say, there's never been political authority in Kabul that exercised full control over the entire geographic expression of Afghanistan. And therefore, our effort to create a government that's going to exercise that kind of authority, tough problem, maybe undoable. 7.5 years into it, frankly, it's not going all that well. So rather than saying, send more troops to Afghanistan, we've got to support President Karzai, we have to do all these things, my own sense is that we need to recognize what the history of Afghanistan tells us, and that is that political authority tends to be decentralized. Political authority tends to be exercised by people we call warlords, you know, tribal leaders and the like, and that perhaps there is a strategy to be found in empowering local leaders to do for us what we want. There'll also be a point of concurrence, empowering them to do what they want. What do they want to do? They want to exercise control over their own jurisdiction. Great. We should support that so long as that control over their jurisdiction precludes any significant Taliban presence and activity. The truth is, all we really care about in Afghanistan is that it not be a base for Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorist activity. If the tribal leaders do that for us, then that would be sufficient, and that would make it unnecessary for us to sustain this protracted U.S. military presence. Yes, ma'am.
What I would like to know is what you think about the importance that oil played in the invasion of Iraq and the war on Kabul.
Sure. the role of oil. I guess it would be reassuring in a way, because it would make everything so black and white and simple if we could say, yeah, Bush, oil man, Cheney oil man. They got together in the Oval Office one afternoon and said, ah, Iraq, oil, let's go for it. Because we would be able to say, God, they're just a couple of crumb bums and, you know, just, that's not the way it is, right? We didn't invade Iraq to get the oil. The oil was already available. I mean, it was already being produced for the global market. Having said that, it's certainly true that were it not for the oil, that is to say, that were it not for the fact that such a large percentage of the world's oil reserves happen to exist in the Persian Gulf, we wouldn't care any more about the Persian Gulf than we care about Antarctica. It would have zero strategic significance. Not zero. They still had the Suez Canal. But I mean, it would have very little strategic significance. Because the world economy runs on oil, because we have, for decades, on the one hand, recognized that oil dependence is a problem, and on the other hand, refused to do anything about it, over time, the strategic significance of the Persian Gulf has come to be ever greater and ever greater. So it is a war about oil in the sense that oil lends to the Persian Gulf its strategic importance. It's not a war about oil in the sense that the proximate or immediate or narrow purpose of the invasion was to get the oil. Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to Boston University Professor of International Relations, Dr. Andrew Bacevich, speaking on The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Professor Bacevich was introduced by Dr. John LaRosa, president of the Friends of the Libraries at Boston University. Tonight's lecture was sponsored by the Friends of the Libraries and the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian Kennedy. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.